Be good.
Hello there, friend. Thanks so much for tuning into the Monkey Tooth Podcast. This is Andrew, and my wife Tiffany and our little dog Pele are outside of the van right now playing in a birch tree forest in Fairbanks, Alaska, where we are having an amazing time. We absolutely love it. Alaska has been amazing to us, and it's not just because of the scenery and the beautiful mountains and the tundra and the trees and the animals. That's all been great. What has been incredibly outstanding to us, anyhow, are the people that we've met, travelers and locals alike. We've met some proper characters. We're actually staying in a yard of a pretty interesting character right now in Fairbanks, who's going to be on the show later. We just finished recording a podcast with him. But the episode that you're about to hear right now, is, should you continue to listen to this after my little intro, is with the guy we met in Homer, Alaska. Now, this guy is Bill Gilbert. He works for the U.S. State Department and in a diplomatic role, as well as just working in the consulate, helping people with visas and things like that. He's worked all over the world, a lot in Latin America, but other locations, you'll hear all about it. Really cool guy, really fascinating. We went on a hike with him, got to eat dinner with him and just sort of spend some good quality time. And I don't know, I thought he was a great guy and wanted to get his story down on tape and share it with you guys. If you are, if you have a particular political lean, or maybe you do or do not like the United States, listen to this with an open mind and be willing to, expand your horizons and maybe hear something you don't agree with or something you do agree with, but voiced in a way you hadn't thought about before. I certainly don't necessarily 100% agree with everything that Bill said, but I certainly agree that the guy saying it is coming from a good place. I believe in Bill Gilbert, and I believe in what he's doing. And I don't know. I'm just glad to have gotten the opportunity to talk to him. I didn't, try to hold his feet to the fire for everything that the U.S. government has ever done. It's not his job to defend it, and it's not my job to push on the guy who's ostensibly my guest. I was just happy to talk to him and hear his points of view. So if you are in any way tweaked by our conversation, I want you to reach out to me at mtp.dog. Let me know what I could have done differently or what you think I could have done differently, or just let me know what you think. But anyhow, I hope you enjoy this episode. I hope you go to mtp.dog and read our journal, check out our route map, see where we've been, where we're going, leave us a note. You can go from there to our Patreon page where you can support us for as little as 25 cents a month. Sorry, 25 cents an episode, $1 a month. Or you can just go to our Instagram and Facebook pages and look at pictures and all that sort of stuff if that's your thing. But I want to say, if you have not already gone to iTunes, just hit pause as soon as I'm done with these couple of sentences and go there and write a review. Just tell old iTunes what you think of this show, particularly if you think it's good, because that will help people find out about this show. And that's what we want. We want to share the stories that we're getting from the road with the people out there in the world. All right. So I'm going to shut up now and get right on to this episode with Mr. Bill Gilbert. I hope you enjoy it. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
I'm a United States Foreign Service officer. I'm a diplomat, so my job generally involves working for embassies and consulates around the world representing the United States. My specialty is public diplomacy, which is basically public affairs work. But I've done more work in the consular realm, and that has to do with either adjudicating visas for people that want to visit the United States or want to emigrate to the United States, and also to take care of and help U.S. citizens abroad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from the state of Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. I'm here in the state of Alaska, that's, I think, about 500 times bigger.
And it is far away from Rhode Island as you can get and still be in North America.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm pretty far away.
Yeah. So what led you into State Department? Were you military?
It's interesting because I started working for the government more than 30 years ago. I was a business major at Boston University, didn't want to work in the corporate world, but wanted to travel, wanted to get paid to travel. So I was looking at either the Peace Corps or the military, but I had a lot of really heavy student loans and I needed to make money. My parents I wasn't from a very economically privileged background. So I decided to join the Air Force. And the Air Force sent me first to Northern Maine, and then they sent me, which was a little bit like here, except more sparse and colder.
Yeah.
And then I went to Panama, and I got thrust into the invasion of Panama. I arrived like 3 months before the U.S. sent like 30,000 troops down.
Yeah.
It was during the time of Manuel Noriega. Mm-hmm. And that was something. And then I ended up staying in Panama almost 4 years, got married to a Panamanian, had a kid in Panama. And by then, my Spanish had gotten really, really good. And so then I joined later. I wanted to get a PhD in Latin American literature. Mm. I wanted to be a college professor. I was very interested in colonial Latin American narratives, chronicles of the initial encounter between the Europeans and Native Americans.
You're a big fan of atrocity. narrativization.
I'm very interested in how that all happened. I mean, it is a pretty horrible thing. I went from there to teaching in private high schools, Spanish. Mm-hmm. Really enjoyed it. I started a really neat exchange program in Panama where we brought North American kids to a small town in the interior of Panama, did community service with a shelter for malnourished children, and they stayed in families where they had to speak Spanish, but the kids were really well matched, and so they enjoyed themselves, and it was fantastic. The families were warm and welcoming. It was a great program. And I did that for a bunch of years and decided to stay with the military. I was in the Air Force, but in the reserves. Mm-hmm. And I managed to figure out how to get to work for the U.S. Southern Command in Miami, going down to Latin America and doing conferences and working in U.S. embassies in Latin America as a military officer.
Yeah.
But today, the concept of how an embassy runs is pretty cool because the military, when they're working in a particular country, unless they're at war, fall under the command of the ambassador, who's the president's representative in that country, which means the ambassador, you know, calls the shots. And the military officers have bosses in the Pentagon and in Miami at U.S. Southern Command, but in the field, the ambassador has authority.
Yeah.
And the military officers are very aware of that, and they follow the authority of the chain of command of the ambassador within the embassy. So they're just a member of what they call the country team. Mm-hmm. And so as a U.S. officer, I got to do that in Venezuela, which is fascinating because it was headed in kind of a sad direction under Hugo Chavez. And then shortly after that, I went to Nicaragua for a year, and it was kind of the opposite. The country was seeking relations with the United States for the first time since the Sandinista Revolution in 1979. And I was one of the first United States military officers to open relations with the Sandinista Army. And that was really cool.
Yeah, I can imagine. What was that like?
I mean, it was great because I like these guys. They were...
How did they feel about you or about Americans?
You know, they were... You'd think they'd be more resentful considering that we were their enemy when they were young.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, now they were the guys in charge, and, you know, they were grandparents and, you know, had their ranches, and, you know, they weren't super wealthy, most of them, but they had comfortable lives and they were leaders. Hmm. And a lot of them had been trained by the Russians.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Some of them spoke Russian. They'd spent a lot of time in Cuba. But I liked them. I admired them. They did amazing things. They were really effective military on a very small budget. Hmm. They didn't waste anything. And they won their war against the U.S.-backed Contra rebels. They prevailed. They came out on top. And most of them were really cool. Yeah. I was proud of working with them. I liked working
That's
with them.
That's great.
And they weren't anti-U.S. Hmm. In fact, a lot of the work that we did, myself and my bosses, and it led to, like, I don't think they really knew what to expect from us.
Yeah.
Because we were so unknown to them. All we were was the enemy, but now, you know, the Cold War had been over for over 20 years, and they were like, well, you know, I mean, the United States isn't that bad. They were open, and they really were. And I think we made a difference. We changed attitudes and perceptions, and, you know, they dialogued with us, and we had good relations with them.
Yeah. So when you're doing like a almost a PR job essentially, or that relations job with or diplomatic relations would be a better way to put it. What I mean, are you hosting concerts? Or are you what are you?
All sorts
of things. Exporting like American culture.
Yes, like a lot of it's like cultural attaché work or press work. I prefer the cultural side.
Yeah, have some fun.
Yeah, I mean, like we would bring artists and musicians from the United States over to the countries that we were working in. And
so, what were you like helping find venues, find artists?
Yeah.
What all was your role there?
Absolutely, and also setting up speaking opportunities for our ambassador and other leaders within within the embassy. Doing a lot of work with youth. I did a lot of work with sports diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know, working with underprivileged kids in different areas.
Yeah.
And working in sponsoring sporting events. And then, you know, at some point we'd bring the ambassador out there and he'd talk with the kids.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I think it's effective. I think it's money well spent.
Certainly better than dropping bombs or paying someone else to. selling something.
Well, diplomats are all about trying to avoid war and keep the peace.
Yeah.
A little bit different from being in the military.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I love about the way we set things up in the United States now, you know, as I said, with the exception of war, during peacetime, the military personnel that work in a given country fall under the command of the ambassador who works for the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
And when we sell, you know, the United States sells military equipment, military systems to other countries, it all falls under the oversight of the State Department.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a job I would not want. There's a lot to answer for.
Right, no, I'm not going to go in, because I worked on that in Nicaragua, right? But it was a happy story.
Oh, that's good.
Because our ambassador
need more of those.
Was a public diplomacy officer, and she was very enlightened, lovely lady. And she said, we're not going to give weapons. They didn't have any money. Mm. We gave them grants. So in countries that don't have a lot of money, the United States often will, you know, have a budget set aside to give grants. And it's, you know, it's generally to further some U.S. objective in the region.
Sure.
Which sounds maybe...
It is what it is.
But in Nicaragua, look, these people had tons of weapons. They've been at war for 25 years. We weren't going to give them more weapons. What's the point in that?
Yeah.
So instead, we went out and got them radios. We basically focused on trying to... they have a lot of natural disasters there, a lot of volcanoes.
Yeah.
And they've had hurricanes and earthquakes, terrible earthquakes there. Brutal. And so we bought them radios, we bought them, you know, rescue equipment. Yeah. I think that was money well spent. And it was something, you know, for a really good purpose. And they appreciated it. And, you know, that, I mean, obviously we're trying to buy influence.
We're
plain and clear. We give you all this great equipment, and so listen to us.
Yeah.
We'd like to give you more equipment. Yeah. How about listen to this, you know?
I often see the working of a country, not just exclusively the U.S., but just a country. They seem like businesses to me. They're set up more like a for-profit business, in so far as the way that the infrastructure works and the goal, you know, and a lot of things get sort of turned into commodity. You know, the labor force works the same. I mean, what you're describing is an office scenario that if you took out keywords and put in other words, it would be, hey, we at work for Kellogg, and we're, you know, bringing Rice Krispies to the Philippines or whatever it is. You know, there's that sort of thing. I mean, it's almost the same sort of apparatus from my limited experience.
Yeah, and a lot of public diplomacy work has to do with, you know, improving our brand.
I mean,
we use that language because we want our, you know, our brand to be looked upon favorably, and people want, you know, to want to have our brand. One thing I would like to say, which I think is really interesting, is because you asked me how I got in the State Department. And after working in the military for a while, I was teaching school, I'd been in academia, and I'd been in the military. And I thought, well, the marriage of those two things is the State Department.
Wow.
And my dad wanted, he made three suggestions in my life that turned out to be fabulous. They were all three things he wanted to do, and he never did, for various reasons, but, you know, that's his decisions.
Sure, sure.
He decided not to pursue these, but he suggested me to do them. And as most teenagers, you know, I said, oh, it's my dad, I'm really not going to listen to this. And, you know, he didn't do it. Why would I do something, you know, that he himself hasn't gone and done? But they turned out to be great recommendations. There were three. One was learn a foreign language. And I was, in high school, didn't like foreign languages, never thought I'd do it. And today I'm fluent in Spanish. I speak so a couple other languages a little bit, but and then I'm about to study Arabic now,
so it's
gonna be a challenge. The second thing he said was join the U.S. Foreign Service. Can you imagine? He told me that when I was 17.
Wow.
I didn't even know what it was, but he had looked into it and decided not to do it. But I remember him telling me that, and I, you know, sure enough, that's what I eventually did. And the third was the military. And he had been in the military, enlisted, and he said, well, you know, you should think about being an officer in the military. Get a college degree and then go in the military as an officer. And I did that. And even though I am not by nature a martial person, and I, you know, I kind of a duck or a swan in the duck pond or in the military, you know, it's one of the best things I ever did for myself. And I'm proud that I did it, that I went through it, and I was able to contribute and perform, even though that's not my nature. And I always told people I was kind of like the canary in the mine shaft, you know, because I'm very pro U.S. military. In an academia and in more liberal circles, there's this fear of the military and this unfair stereotype that, you know, military people are all radical, you know, right wing. And it's that's not true. Part of it might be true, but I mean, they are dedicated to the profession of arms. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But there are also a lot of awesome people. And it provides, the U.S. military provides opportunities for a lot of kids from the inner cities or from, you know, rural areas that wouldn't have opportunities otherwise.
Is it not one of the biggest employers in the country?
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah. But it's also very progressive. And
in
it's
what way?
Like race relations in the United States, a military, while not perfect,
sure,
they're probably better than any university in the United States, honestly.
Really?
You know, because for the most part, you're judged on what you do at work, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, people look at your rank to determine how important you are. And if you perform your duty, you know, you're respected.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
You don't really hear about that.
It's very, very good. All you hear about is when something goes wrong or is something bad. Because they're open. They're open to oversight.
And as it should be. I mean, if you think about what it is, I mean, it's a...
And my son's in the Army, and he's having a very good experience. You
know? Where is he stationed?
He's
abroad?
Stationed in the United States right now. And so, you know, I joined the U.S. Foreign Service. Another thing I might say about the U.S. Foreign Service that I think is really interesting and worth... It's worth people knowing about this because I think it's cool. Is it used to be, they used to joke and say it was all white. No, it was all Pale male in Yale, U.S. Foreign Service. That's great. And like, women could not be in the Foreign Service unless they were single. If they got married, they had to get out. This is like before like the 1970s.
Yeah.
And most women that were in were like secretaries or, you know, they fetched the coffee, that sort of thing.
Right.
And it all, you know, with the equal rights movement, that all changed. And it, of course, didn't change overnight.
Sure.
But I would say by now it's, you know, it's changed a lot. And yeah, we're maybe 40% female, 60% male. A lot of ambassadors are women now.
Yeah, that's great.
What I was gonna say about the State Department, which I love, is not only that, but there's a tremendous diversity of backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so there's, unlike before, where you had to go to certain prep schools and you had to go to Ivy League schools or whatever to be, you know, invited into the club, today it is entirely transparent, completely open to any American, U.S. citizen that's an adult. You have to be between the ages of 18 and 60. You know, if you can do well on the in the hiring process, you'll get hired.
Hmm.
And so in my, you know, when I entered them in my initial class that we had there, we had people that ran restaurants, we had actors, we had lots of lawyers, lots of people with military backgrounds, but people with, one guy was a comedian, professional comedian. And so people from really wide, diverse backgrounds.
Yeah.
And that was okay. In fact, I think the Foreign Service looks for that because we're representing America.
Yeah, if so you're pushing a brand.
Right. Why would we want to only show one type of U.S. citizen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're a very diverse and big country.
Yeah.
So I like that a lot because you just go take the test and it's free to do it. You can take it anywhere in the United States. They have test centers in every state, I think.
Hmm.
And if you do well in the process, you get a fair shake at being hired. It's not easy to get hired, but you can, yeah.
So how many different countries have you worked in?
I've worked so far as a diplomat in only three countries. I've done three tours. I'm about to do my fourth.
Yeah, you were just in Ecuador, right?
I was just in Ecuador. My first was in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
They've all been very interesting. The second one was in Singapore, doing public diplomacy work. And the third was in Ecuador.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, on a personal level, that was the most satisfactory because, you know, I'm fluent in Spanish. It's a gorgeous country.
Yeah.
And my wife and I really, really enjoy that.
Yeah.
Ecuador. Singapore, I worked all the time.
Mm.
But did some fascinating things working for a super cool ambassador. And then in Ciudad Juarez, I was there at the height of, like, when it was one of the most violent cities in the world.
Yeah.
And I never personally witnessed any violence, but every day we'd hear about some attack that was, like, really close to where we worked or lived.
Wow.
And that was really heavy because I interviewed people from Ciudad Juarez that wanted to get visas to the United States. And there was, like, this collective trauma in that city, where almost everybody was affected by it. And the murders were terrible, but they were the tip of the iceberg. Underneath that, you had all sorts of other crimes. I think the worst was like the protection money that you had to pay if you ran a business.
Mm.
And, you know, you basically lived in fear because if someone from the cartels wanted to push you around,
they could, and
no one could protect you. And yet it also has a huge number of factories and a lot of jobs. And so a lot of people were trapped. They couldn't leave because
that's where they worked.
That's where they worked. And the jobs were good despite the situation there. So I'll never forget one of my first interviews when I was giving visa interviews. There was a young man that came up to the window. He's very honest with me. He said, I want to go to the United States because the gangs are trying to get me to join them and I don't want to do it, but they're not going to give me a choice. He goes, and so I want to go to the United States. And I had to refuse him. I had to say, I'm sorry, you don't qualify for the visa to the United States, because he was basically telling me that he was not coming back if we gave him this visa.
Mm.
And, you know, I had to say no, because that was my job. My job was to determine, are you going to use this visa appropriately, or are you going to go in the United States and not come back on a tourist visa? And he didn't get the visa, which was kind of sad.
Do you know? Do you end up knowing what happened to him? Or
no, I have no idea. I have no idea. Although we approved a lot of visas there because a lot of people just wanted to go and shop at Walmart. They lived on the border, and you know they liked Walmart, so they could. They could pay 50 cents for take a bus to take them across the border, which was like a 10-minute ride.
Yeah.
So if you came in and just said that, you know, and we believed you, we often just approved the visa.
I really liked El Paso. We rode through there on our bikes and found it to be, our impression was that that's like the future of America. What America is going to look like in the future. Because it wasn't just Hispanic. I mean, it was this wild melting pot of... lots of different cultures.
Yeah, and there's a lot of U.S. military there too.
Yeah, it's an interesting place. It was beautiful and crazy windy, and just I mean, it was just kind of an intense experience to be there. But it was also it was fun and alive and kind of cool.
I liked it.
Yeah,
I liked the area.
It's a bummer to look at the Rio Grande.
Yeah, it's all
like
dried
just,
up.
Yeah, yeah, you just see these concrete embankments.
It's much prettier up in New Mexico. And I hear downriver there's some water too.
It's
all been diverted off, I guess.
Right, but seeing that, all the things that you kind of worry about with America and all the things that look kind of cool about America, you can kind of see it all right there. And Texas is an incredible place anyway.
Well, so is California.
Sure,
you see
sure.
a lot there as well. The future is usually comes out of California.
Yeah, I can see that.
One thing I wanted to say, though, is that in this interview, because it was one of the things that made me really happy I'm doing this job, is that in Singapore, we had an ambassador. He's really a really extraordinary individual. He's part of a small group of people that started the Obama campaign.
Oh,
so
really?
He's really close friends with a former president.
That's cool.
And he was a Canadian who naturalized the United States, and so... he was an immigrant who is now the U.S. ambassador
to Singapore.
He was not born. He was born in Canada, but went to college in the United States and fell in love with the country and became successful. And and so he was named the U.S. ambassador to Singapore. He's not a professional diplomat. He came out of private sector as a trial attorney. And but he was one of the key instrumental people in getting a win for the Obama campaign in Florida, the state of Florida. So the president sent him to Singapore to be our ambassador there. And he just made you really proud to be an American. He, first of all, I will say, when the Republican, we had a lot of congressional delegations come through there. Probably 70 or 80% of them were Republican. This guy was clearly a Democrat. You know, he was nominated by a Democratic president. And without it, exception, the Republican Congress people love this guy.
Yeah, just one of those infectiously.
Exactly, and they came away thinking, why can't it be more, you know, like this? You know, like he just was able to bridge gaps and, you know, make friendships. But what's more, what he did representing the United States in Singapore, which I was an integral part of it because I was setting up a lot of his events, was he went out and he told the story about, you know, how much he loves the United States, why he loves the United States, how he was an immigrant that came with next to nothing. Yeah. He was not from a wealthy family, and he made his way there. And that's been the key to success in the United States, for the success of the country, and will continue to be. And his favorite question to answer was people that said, well, you know, how would you comment on the obvious decline of the United States and the rise of China?
Yeah.
And he loved to take that question because he wasn't disrespectful to China, but he just said, that's not true. And I'll prove it. I'll show you why it's not true. He said, where is all the innovation coming? Mm. Not all, but the lion's share of innovation in the world coming from now. It's coming from the United States. You know, apps, Facebook, you name it. Any large number, an array of startups that have revolutionized the world, Uber, Airbnb, they're all coming out of the United States. Yeah. And we still have, you know, the most remarkable university system in the world, and the best and the brightest from all around the world come and study in the United States. Yeah. And, you know, what language now do people in the world want to speak? Everybody wants to speak English. This is no other era of human history have you seen a language rise to such a a level of... didn't
come from U.S.
No, it didn't originally come from the United States, but the reason that it's being, you know... No, it's true, yeah. But, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is he made it easy to do my job because it's like, wow, you know, these are all really great things about our country, and we get to promote them.
Yeah, it's infectious. Right now, I'm thinking, I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm like, ah, man, that is great. It's exciting.
And we'll be back. We'll be back there. We'll be back there. What's happening now is you know, there's a reaction a little bit to the message that ambassador had.
Yeah.
But it's not going to prevail. Yeah. The United, what makes us great is what our ambassador in Singapore was talking about.
Yeah.
And that hasn't gone away.
Right. I mean, I think that's just to that sort of idea of, and I don't know that you're necessarily promoting exceptionalism, but the idea of greatness, there is a difference and a distinction between those two things.
No, we had that conversation last night. I do not like the idea of exceptionalism.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it's arrogant. I mean, I think that
right.
the United States is great. I honestly believe that, but I believe that humbly, not in the sense that we're somehow...
We figured it out and everybody else is fucking
up. Yeah, we're naturally better than other people.
No.
In fact... Clearly, it's something about the story that we have and the opportunity that we offer.
Yeah,
you know, and then people from other places come and make it theirs. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And when we do our best to live up to the ideals that we've set out as a country and as a company, you know, when we actually achieve those, it is great. It is wonderful. And we have such an amazing time traveling around and the freedoms that we have. To do what we're doing,
and
in this
I'd like to address one incredible. Other thing here too, right? Because all right, so you may say I'm a lackey for the United States. I don't know, but
in the pejorative. But
look, I've seen a lot,
right?
And I'm a liberal from the Northeast.
Yeah,
all right, the canary in the mineshaft. Remember that now. And I've had a long association with the U.S. military, and I'm not going to talk about what happened prior to the end of the Cold War, because the United States did some things that I don't think we should be very proud of, to be honest with you.
Sure. Yeah.
But since the end of the Cold War, since 1989 when I was in the invasion of Panama, the United States has not done that. And in fact, we've done an awful lot of good in Latin America, and I've been witness to that.
Yeah,
a friend of mine... It's funny, in the U.S. Air Force, they're the least enlightened of the three services. I can say this because I'm no longer in the military. and as much as I like the military, there's something about the Air Force that kind of bugs me.
Really?
And the reason is because they're technocrats, right? I mean, they're all about flying airplanes and making sure everything's perfect and there aren't any accidents, which is an attitude that, or a sort of a philosophy that it works for what they do, right? But so they also talk about how they want a lot of their officers to learn other languages, and they want to promote their officers working with other services and working in other countries. But they don't really mean it, because you don't get promoted doing that in the Air Force. In the Army, you do. You can make a good career in the Marine Corps, learning languages and traveling around the world. And the Navy's kind of in the middle. But what's interesting about all of that is that... Despite that, I had a friend. He came up with me as a lieutenant, and he had a really good career. He became a full colonel, which is that's an accomplishment. And he did it working for the United States Southern Command as the human rights officer.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Because that was important to the four-star commander in Southcom.
Yeah.
That's what we were pushing. That was a priority.
Yeah.
And in fact, a lot of training that the U.S. military officers—they used to run this School of Americas, which was connected back in the day with torture and training dictators and things like that. They moved it; they changed its name. It's Fort Benning, Georgia now. It's called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Studies or something like that. No. But now, a large part of what they're mandatory there, what they have to teach, is courses on human rights.
Yeah.
And this is no joke. This isn't like window washing or just trying to hide. No.
Yeah.
And whenever the U.S. military sends somebody or pays for someone to do something, to go to the United States for a trip or training, they vet them. Mm-hmm. And if there's the slightest concern that there are any human rights violations in that individual's background, they don't get to go.
Yeah.
And their United States military doesn't want anything to do with them. And it's changed. The whole attitude has changed. Most of what the U.S. military does in Latin America today is, you know, literally build bridges, clinics.
Yeah.
They'll send ships into different ports in Latin America and then offer free medical services to underprivileged population. It's awesome, and I'm a big fan.
I'm very undereducated in this area.
I'm gonna have witnesses.
I'm taking you at your word.
And we don't get that word out.
Sure.
No one knows this, right? I mean, the people that we help know it.
Yeah.
And it's all part of an embassy plan, right? You know, the country team plan.
Sure.
So it's not, the military is subservient to this, and they just bring their assets because they've got boats and airplanes that can fly things in quickly and help and do these amazing humanitarian projects. And we don't get good press for it because we're like slow at that sort of thing. And the generals know about it. They're trying to fix it. But anyway, I'm talking about Latin America.
Sure, So that leads me to the next thing you were talking about. And I do actually really want to get back to that school that you're talking about, the with the malnourished children and the exchange program. But before we go back, I want to go a little bit forward and talk. You said you were going to learn some Arabic. So we're talking about Latin America and how the U.S.
a completely different road.
Well, the U.S. is doing quite well in Latin America. You're heading into a place where I would argue, even at my uneducated viewpoint, that we have not done particularly well. In fact, that we have severely damaged the area of the world that you're heading towards. And some good brand management almost seems like, I don't even know how you do it. I mean, we've really talked about human rights.
I'm not really going to be able to talk about this with any authority, only because I haven't done
been
it
there yet.
You know, I haven't been. I've never been to that part of the world. Mm. I'm learning Arabic, which I'm a little bit scared about because it's going to be hard.
It's a tough language.
Tough language. Maybe I'll have to let you know in 3 years because.
Well, but what's your sense in heading into it? Do you feel like you're heading into a quagmire, or do you feel like you seem like a pretty upbeat and positive dude? Do you feel?
Well, my job there is going to be consular work, and that'll be basically just involved in visa work.
Okay.
So it's more methodical, less controversial.
Mm.
I mean, the policies that are set by the president and by Congress are very controversial. There's no doubt about that. But my job's just to implement whatever the immigration and the laws are and the policies are.
And
you'll
be seeing people from all over the Middle East. That are
possibly
making their way to
a lot of Syrians go to Lebanon now for visas, I think.
I mean, I imagine a lot of people from a lot of countries that can get there are heading there and looking for refuge and for
I'm sure it's going to be a much different job. And you know, I mean, when I'm not unaware of the of the history there, and it'll be challenging. There's a little bit of trepidation in heading there right now.
I think about that, you know, what you were saying, the sort of the greatness and the opportunity and the beauty and the things that we can, the positive things that the American experiment can shine upon the world. Trying to take that narrative and you're dealing with a Syrian who you can't determine whether or not you feel they're dangerous and they clearly are coming from a place where there's help. How do you square those two things? I don't know. It's just your job to me seems so fraught with, because you seem emotional and really you care and you give a shit and you love this country and you love human beings. You're not just a America first kind of guy.
No.
You know, you're doing this to bridge cultures. I don't know how. I mean, I'm glad there are people who are as forthright and considerate as you are doing your job, but what is that? What's the emotional toll there when you have, like the story you told me about the guy that you had to say, no, you can't come in. You just told me the truth.
Yeah.
You can't come in.
Yeah.
You're in danger, but you can't come to my country.
one thing that makes it easy. Okay, so let me go back and there's a fundamental difference between tourist visas and immigrant visas.
Sure.
Tourist visas are at the discretion, and it's an invitation to come to the United States, or and this is true for any country in the world,
right?
We'll give you the visa because go ahead. We think you're going to be fine to go and visit the United States, and we'd like you to do that. But it's an invitation. It's not a right. Mm. And if you turn someone down, you're saying, oh, you can't do a vacation. Well, big deal. Now, if it's more than a vacation, then you made the right choice by saying, because that means that person wasn't going to use the visa correctly. They were lying to you and telling you they're going to take a vacation when they really weren't. They were going to live or work there.
Right.
If you're going to live or work there, then you should ask for a work visa or for an immigrant visa. And so on the immigrant visa side, it's governed by laws. So as a consular officer, I follow the laws.
Right, right.
Whatever they may be. And I have my personal opinions about immigrant law, and I think there should be a lot of changes made in them, which I won't go into in this interview. But I get your point, and there's a little bit of trepidation. I'm not sure what I'm headed into. What reassures me is that unlike public diplomacy work, where you're crafting a message and you really need to put your heart and soul in it, and you're trying to persuade people, in the consular job that I'll be doing, I'm just either implementing the law or making a judgment call on what this person's, and I think this person's intentions are for going to the United States. And so there's very little emotion in that job. There shouldn't be.
I guess not.
Yeah, no. I'd rather do that type of work right now. And maybe that sounds cowardly, but I loved doing the public diplomacy in Singapore because it was so upbeat. And I worked a lot. I will say this. I worked a lot with Muslim youth groups in Southeast Asia. And I think I did a lot of good. I really do.
That's great.
I mean, I think I connected with those young people and that they had a much more favorable impression of the United States than they had previously because it was a person-to-person contact. And we did fun things with them. And we listened to them and, supported them. Yeah. And that was really, really cool work.
Yeah.
Could I do that in the Middle East? Yeah, I think so. But I probably should be younger. And you have to speak Arabic really well.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I think I could do that in Latin America. And I think I'd enjoy it a lot.
Sure.
I think I'd be good. I think I would earn my money. Yeah. I'd earn my paycheck.
I can imagine.
Yeah. I did in Singapore. I know I did.
Yeah. Well, let's jump back on the exchange program because you.
Oh, sure.
So you were teaching in St. Louis.
Yeah, a private school in St. Louis, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Great, progressive, fantastic school that taught manners. It taught a whole education. It wasn't just about academics.
Yeah.
Called the John Burroughs School. I loved working there. I think very highly of the school. My son went there.
That's great. He got
a great education in every sense of the word. And so I'd actually started the program before I started working in St. Louis. I taught in a prep school in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually started it from there.
And what's the name of it?
The school in Boston was the Noble and Greenough School. It's another excellent small private school.
Yeah. And the program, you were taking kids from the States, bringing them to
Panama.
To Panama.
Yep.
And like sort of embedding with families.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a cool place to go because unfortunately a lot of places where programs take students are tourist destinations. So they're crammed with tourists and a lot of people speak English and a lot of times the families speak English.
Yeah.
And so the most effective immersion programs are those programs where you really have to speak in the target language in Spanish.
Yeah.
In that case. And in this program, we were not in a tourist area. We were in an area where there's no tourists.
Yeah.
And that was great because it's just a small town but it wasn't an impoverished town. It was like a pretty vibrant place. And mm-hmm. the families that we placed our students were, they were middle-class families, really interesting people. They were interested in hosting American students.
Yeah.
They didn't speak English, but they had great interactions and I had a homestay coordinator from the town who is just gifted. She knew exactly how to do this and she made amazing. I mean, these teenagers would meet and they'd be like best friends like 2 days later, speaking in Spanish.
That's fantastic.
Some of them actually went to the United States,
but
they arranged it. My program was not an exchange program, so they would arrange that on their own. You know, the parents U.S. kids would invite the Panamanian kid to come up later and spend some time in the United States.
I like the idea that the kids that you brought down were not just learning Spanish language skills in the most utilitarian sense, but they were, having to emote. They were like playing with kids, and like malnourished kids were coming in from communities around and being sort of supported in this, in this environment. And these kids from the States were, it's one thing to learn how to ask where the toilet is. It's another thing to entertain a child and get into that sort of, heartstring pulling.
I'll give you a very specific anecdote. One of the kids that I brought down there came from a very wealthy family, and a very influential family, nice family, like good people. And this boy was born with a cleft palate. And because his family was wealthy and had access, to some of the best hospitals in the United States and the world, he had his cleft palate, operated on, and you could barely tell now. But when we went into the shelter for malnourished children, he immediately gravitated towards a child with a cleft palate, and there was nothing they could do for the child because there weren't resources to operate on him. And that little boy stayed with the boy from the teenager from the United States, and they bonded. And he had such a good experience, both did, but the teenager did, that he actually came back on the trip for a second stay.
That's beautiful.
And he's a really good kid. He ended up going to Harvard, and I don't know what he does now, but he's going to be a very successful, influential person someday. But he's good people, and he sat down on the floor in that, children's shelter in rural Panama and played with that little boy, for about 3 weeks every day.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. We're looking forward to being in Panama, and that's something we'd like to actually see.
It's a great country.
If at all possible.
And you're going to be driving through Panama, so, there's so many places to stop along the way. Costa Rica gets all the press, and it's a lovely country.
Sure.
But Panama is just as awesome, and it doesn't have all the international attention, which in some ways is a good thing.
Particularly if you're looking for something off the beaten path.
Yeah.
Can you help? So we get a lot of people who are worried about us and where we're traveling.
Okay.
And we also hear a lot of worry about the pressure on our borders, that we're just under siege from this wave of immigrants who just want to take all our jobs.
No.
Great. No. We'll put that one aside. So the fear of traveling in Latin America. Now, I don't share this fear. So you have an expertise in this area. Would you maybe say a few things to assuage the grief?
I'd be really, really careful in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Really careful. I'm not saying don't travel there. I'm sure if you take reasonable precautions, you'll probably be fine. There's a lot of crime there.
Sure.
A lot of violent crime. We used to really encourage U.S. citizens not to travel by land in Mexico.
Right.
But I think if you do your research, you travel during the daytime, you stay on major routes, you'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
And of course, Central America has a lot of problems with crime as well.
Right.
But I have a lot of friends that live there and work there, and they move about, and they take reasonable precautions, and they haven't had problems.
Yeah. What would you say is a reasonable precaution? What do you mean by that?
Just be aware of your surroundings. Don't be a target of opportunity. Travel during the daytime, not at night if you can help it.
Yeah.
Try give the impression that you don't have something worth taking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know your van's kind of conspicuous.
Good luck in a giant red shiny van.
But it's so unusual that maybe they'll,
Believe you, we were going to stop washing it as soon as we head south.
That's true, yeah.
We'll just keep the undercarriage clean.
Get a few dents take a sledgehammer to it in certain places where it won't affect functionality.
Right. So what we hear is And it's certainly possible that you can be robbed or killed, or, you know, horrible things can happen in Mexico and in Central America. But, you know, you are equally, I would say, at risk right here to, we walk around bears. There are car accidents that happen all over the place. Sure. We've seen a couple, we think one of them may have been fatal, but we've seen some certainly fatal-esque accidents just on our journey.
Yeah.
You know, it happens all the time. I mean,
you
heard
gotta
of the story
live
of a,
your life. I mean,
you gotta live it. Yeah, yeah.
You might want to consider registering with the State Department, letting them know of your whereabouts, knowing the phone numbers of the local consulate just in case.
Yeah.
In Mexico, we have 10 consulates, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's not bad coverage. Yeah. It's better.
Most
than...
of them are on the border. But
I can imagine.
But we have one in Hermosillo. I actually would recommend going down through Hermosillo.
Where's that?
It's south of Arizona. Like you would cross below Tucson.
Okay.
You know, at
Nogales. Yeah. Nogales, yeah.
And Nogales has a consulate. And then you go down, another 3 or 4 hours, and then you hit the city of Hermosillo.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's pretty sure that's the best route for safety, because the Gulf Coast route is more dangerous. Yeah.
Well, we wanted to go down Baja because we really liked Baja. We drove around.
But the problem then is, how do you get across? Take a ferry?
Yeah, you take the ferry over to Mazatlan from La Paz. And
That might be fun. Yeah, it might be okay. I mean, because so many people do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's another thing is, if you can travel in a caravan, that's always helpful.
Yeah,
you know,
with safety in numbers.
Yeah. Safety in numbers, yeah.
Well, you've not done much to assuage the grief of the people who are worried about us traveling.
Well, I will say this. For example, once you hit Costa Rica, it gets good from there, because Costa Rica and Panama are really safe.
Yeah.
Nicaragua used to be really safe. Right now, they're going through a bit of a rough spot. But, you know, it's probably still pretty safe other than Managua. And then in South America, it's one of the best times ever to travel there.
Yeah. We're enjoying and we're staying in the moment where we are. We're very happy to be in Alaska. But we're very excited about the southern region.
I just came from Ecuador a couple of weeks ago. And I lived there for 2 years, drove everywhere, never had a single worry or problem. But avoid the cities if you can, right? I mean, if you're going to go into a city, be very careful, be very aware.
Yeah.
Do your research ahead of time. Stay in places that you've heard are fine.
Right.
Don't invite
that's
problems.
That's the thing that, we're not the first people doing this. You know, there's an enormous body of information out there to find out what's good and what's not. There are applications that you can put in your phone that'll tell you what, you know, that sort of thing. So it's for me, I mean, there's always fear, you know, there's always the what ifs that exist in everything. I think about them a lot.
You can find that staying in one place. So
most definitely. Gosh, was it you or Elise that was telling us a story of someone getting killed by a rock falling out of the back of a truck?
Yeah.
Just
it wasn't me, but I heard that story.
Yeah. That was someone they weren't even a driver in a car. They're just a passenger, and all of a sudden a rock comes through the windshield.
It can happen at any time.
Yeah, you're just on the knife's edge at all times. So.
That's true.
On that positive note.
My mom told me a story once. I think it was a true story. There was an astronaut that went to, I don't know if he went to the moon or he went to outer space. He came home and slipped and died in his bathtub.
Oh my God.
He drowned in his own bathtub after going to outer space. So, hey.
Yeah. Illegal drug killed Tom Petty and Prince.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, after all the crazy shit those guys had taken in their time, it was something they could buy over the counter from a doctor that got them, you know. Yeah, you just never know.
I think you guys will be fine because you seem like you're, you know, sensible people, and you know, you probably have pretty good spidey sense. That's what I'm guessing.
Well, you obviously haven't listened to our show.
I haven't yet. So,
man, well, thank you very much for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Is there anything else you want to say to the world, people? Worried about America.
Go USA.
USA.
I mean, there's a lot of good news out there.
Mm.
And the United States is doing a lot of good things. And one of the things I've really admired seeing over the last couple of years is how nonpartisan my organization is. that they still do their job, even though maybe, you know, a number of people don't agree with with the policies of the current administration. Yeah. They do their duty, and they support their elected leaders, and things continue to, you know, a lot of really good things continue to happen in the name of the U.S. government. Because I'm a witness to it, I see it daily.
Yeah.
And so I still serve with pride.
Yeah.
And still love my country. I don't know. I think that going now to I'm going to Beirut in my next assignment. I'm learning Arabic. You know, I've never shrunk away from things like that, and I like that about myself. You know, it's like I'm not.
You're not afraid of it.
No, I mean, maybe I'm kind of dumb. I mean, you know, I guess I don't know what I'm getting myself into. But I've found over the course of my life that often better things happen when I'm courageous and I, you know, I say, you know what, I'm going to do this and see how it works out. And, you know, it's my choice and I accept the consequences of my choice. But you know, there's a lot of good people in the world.
Yeah.
There really are.
Majority.
I had a friend from my hometown who'd never traveled very much. I've probably never been out of the United States unless they maybe went to Acapulco once or something like that. Mm. And this person said to me, why do you want to be over there living in this country where everybody hates Americans? And I thought to myself, I was in Singapore. First of all, Singaporeans love Americans. And you know what? Not just Singaporeans. We're far more alike than we think. In fact, in the Muslim world, you know what? And I witnessed to this. There are millions and millions and millions of people in the Muslim world that get the same message. They're like, why do the Americans hate us? And then they meet an American and it all goes away and they like us and we like them.
Well, you know? I hope that...
And so people should get out and see the
and
world.
See the world, yeah.
Because the world's not that scary.
No.
And when you get out there, and all of a sudden, all of those stereotypes and fears, they just dissipate. And you're like, wow, this person's just like me. Yeah. I remember sitting in a small Malaysian village, watching the interactions of people. The women are all covered with hijabs, you know, with head coverings. The men, you know, sitting around squatting on the floor, smoking cigarettes because everybody there smokes. Thinking to myself, the interactions I'm seeing and the way these people are and... It's just like some small town in the United States. It's no different.
No different.
Honestly, really.
Yeah.
The way they interact, the way they...
Yeah.
And they found me amusing and strange and exotic. And they like me. And, you know, I just smiled and spoke in my broken Malay as best I could.
And that's how you end up with a Malaysian wife?
Yeah. I have a Malaysian wife.
That's great.
And it's, you know, they're fed with a whole bunch of lies about the United States. They are. And the United States has fed a whole bunch of lies about the Muslim world.
Well, I just want to see...
There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Well,
so.
I want to see the distinction between there's a people and then there's a government.
Yeah.
And like you and I mean, I know we are meant to be the government, but we're not. We're just human beings. And everyone that you're going to meet is just a human being. A government is a concept. It's just an idea that's meant to represent a border that we made up and... Yeah, to say a place hates America, well, maybe they do. Maybe they hate American military. Maybe they hate the government, but they don't hate just people.
No.
You know, it's not that those are false narratives that I think are very damaging and unfair. And it's a confusion.
Well, it's
of
interesting
concepts,
too, though, because where do these narratives come from? Right, they're coming from media sources that are just they're incorrect.
It's a weird way to communicate anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always going to miss something in that message. The media, you know, it's the message.
But it's true that there are radical religious people that do some really bad stuff in the world. There's no doubt about that. But they form such a minuscule percentage of that larger group.
Sure.
And most people just want peace, prosperity, good life for their kids, a future.
Yeah.
That's what most people want.
The fact that you're still upbeat about everything is, it's encouraging to me.
Yeah.
And that you're heading into a very tough situation still with that upbeat attitude. And you said something that struck me yesterday, which I very much adopt. Your expectations are low.
Yep.
And that mitigates disappointment.
That's right. I expect it to be difficult and frustrating and dangerous and, you know, so, and I'm not sure how I'm going to deal with being, you know, in a place where I can't easily move about, which given the security situation there, it'll be like that. But I did it in Mexico and, you know, everywhere that we work now in the U.S. Foreign Service, we're subject to a lot of rules and a lot of restrictions.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, I've lived through that before.
Yeah.
And it, you still have opportunities to get to know the country.
Sure.
And I've heard that people in the Muslim world, but especially like the North African, Middle Eastern world, the Arab world, are some of the most hospitable people you'll ever meet.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure I'm going to make friends there.
I'm certain you will. Yeah. I'm certain you will. Yeah. They're...
And I think I'll really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm going to serve the United States and the U.S. interests. I'm going to do that. I swore an oath to do that, and I take it seriously.
It strikes me that you serve, I know you serve this country, but you serve humanity and the better parts of humanity in that you, you know, you're trying to facilitate kind of a peace and love agenda. You know, I mean, there's security in there. You're part of an apparatus that has...
I've been fortunate so far that I've been in places where I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know there are places in the world where it's really hard because, you know, when there's war or heavy conflict, that's very difficult.
Yeah.
I've got a buddy right now who's in Pakistan doing amazing work.
Wow.
I mean, we follow each other on Facebook and I'm like, he's so inspiring.
That's beautiful. You
know, he's connected with all these youth in Pakistan. We need to do more of that. Yeah. Right. I think he's leaving there now, but hopefully he'll continue to go to places where he's needed. Cause he was a former Air Force officer too.
That's cool.
He was a, Air Force public relations officer. So he has a long background doing what he does. He's really good at it.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. He's a good guy. A lot of good guys. We have good people in the
You're good people, man. We met you less than 24 hours ago, and I immediately knew. I was like, all right, this guy's cool, and he's very...
I like my organization. You know, we're not, you know, namsy-pamsy liberals, and, you know, we're realists. We live in the world where we work with the military a lot. We represent the United States. When those Republican Congress people come to abroad, they get treated well. And, you know, the president tried to strip our budget down. I'm not talking about something that's my opinion. This is just a fact.
The reality, yeah.
And Congress blocked it.
Yeah.
And Congress blocked it because they know what we do.
Yeah.
And they know the importance of what we do. And we know we support them and we support the American people. They know that.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that made that decision, they're Republicans. So that warms my heart. And remember what I said about my ambassador in Singapore?
Yes,
I do. He was a large part of that because they know what we do.
Yeah.
They really do.
I'm glad to know more about what you do. You know,
well, I want to get the word out because, you know, I mean, the American people should know what we're doing for them and the value of it because there's a certain element that wanted to just gut us.
And
you know, and that's like a shame because we're important.
Yeah.
And you know what? There are more people in military bands than in the entire U.S. Foreign Service. We're tiny.
Wow.
I forget how big we are, but we're less. I think we're less than 10,000.
Really?
Which is, I mean, the military has
millions. How many bands do we have? Jeez.
We have a lot of bands.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Or I think they said at one point you could take the entire core of the U.S. Foreign Service and put them on one aircraft carrier.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's bananas.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Pentagon budget dwarfs the State Department.
Yeah.
That's just a fact. It's not my opinion.
You know, like I said, it's a tough job. And I think I told you last night about my pal who fell in love with a woman from Iran and whole thing. And you know, it's interesting that I'm getting the opportunity to talk to you, someone who works in that very job, because the hang up in the person that he was focused on was someone at the U.S. consulate, you know, that was trying to negotiate the deal to get the fiance visa and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to hear your perspective and your take on it and what motivates that job. You know,
it can be a hard job sometimes, right? I mean, but I'd go back to what I said earlier about how your friend was dealing with an immigrant visa and we're just bound by law to follow law,
I mean,
whatever it is. We gather the facts and apply the law.
I get it.
Some ways it's comforting, right? But then we really try to help where we can.
Yeah.
And we try to inform people so they know, you know, what the laws are, what the rules are. And with the tourist visa, it's just about going in and convincing a consular officer that, sure, you know, you intend to use the visa appropriately.
Right. And I think comes down to that. In his circumstance, a lot of what was prohibitive wasn't necessarily just the guy doing the job. It was the set of rules that have come down.
Right. From way on above high. His level there. Yeah. It's U.S. law, right?
Yeah. Set by some crazy person.
Well, there were reasons for the laws, but they haven't been changed in a long time. That's the problem. Yeah. And you know, it's just the discussions that the country has had over immigration are so they're so polarized we can't agree on anything, and so nothing changes, and so we're staying with the same law that's been in place for a long time and hasn't adapted to to more recent realities in the world.
Yeah. And well, I was referring mostly to the ban on people from Muslim countries.
The Muslim ban. I'm not going to talk about that.
Fair enough. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you. I wouldn't do it. But I am, like I said, I keep telling you how grateful I am for you to come in and talk.
So. Yeah. You're very welcome. I've enjoyed this. You're a good interviewer.
That's the most generous thing you've said yet.
I hope what I've said doesn't get me in trouble. I don't think so. I don't think I've said anything.
Yeah, well, I'll send you an edit before I publish, I promise.
Yeah, well, for the most part, I imagine most of the folks that listen to you are, you know,
not in the State Department.
No, yeah. You know, are not going to be offended and write their congressman.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, that's the thing. I think if you are offended by this, write me and tell me. let's have a dialogue about it, because the being offended about it is perfectly okay. And I think the polarization in this country isn't about
disagreeing. No, I mean, I'm pretty sure, if anything, I guess maybe one of the things I've been trying to do is address what I assume is a mostly liberal audience with some good news, so you're not totally depressed. I mean, and because people ask me, they're like, how can you, you know,
work for this guy?
Yeah, how can you do this? And I'm like, well, you know, I...
Because you care, it's country before party.
And, you know, when you see countries that are a mess, countries that have all sorts of... Like, Venezuela is a good example. I'll just use it right now. It's... I can say this. I'm not working in Venezuela. It's a total chaos. And people are desperate. It's, like, reduced to, like, a barter economy. You know, the inflation's out of control. It's just a country in collapse. You know, and then you compare what's happened in Venezuela, where the country's just simply falling apart. And there were people in the liberal side of things in the United States that thought Hugo Chavez and this was a real people's revolution, and it was going to be something along the lines of the Cuban Revolution, which, whatever you want to say about the Cuban Revolution, it was far more effective because there's an order there, and the government's in charge, and there are some things that work pretty well there, you know, like the medical system, and we can. I'm not going to go there, but
yeah,
like
you're not an apologist for the Castro family.
No, but Venezuela is not Cuba. It's just it's chaos. It's a country that's fallen apart, and so the revolutionaries did a bad job, and they ruined the country. And I'm not saying there weren't problems that created the so-called revolution, but the revolution has been a disaster for that country. The United States, on the other hand, we have institutions, which a lot of countries in the world don't have, especially in Latin America. They haven't built strong institutions that can stand up to whims and changes in the political ties. Yeah. And I think it's something worth mentioning, right? I mean, if you look at the United States, everyone on the liberal side thought the world was falling apart and it was Chicken Little running around. And yet, honestly, things haven't changed all that much yet. Change is slow,
right.
And that's a great thing because we've built institutions that were built to last, and you know, in some countries, when a new president is elected, they change everybody. They fire the entire government down to the dog catcher and the local librarian,
and just start over.
And in the United States, that does not happen. 90-something% of the people stay right in place, and they are dedicated civil servants who have worked for both Democrats and Republicans through several minutes, you know, through. And that's a really, really good thing because our government doesn't just radically change overnight.
Yeah.
And it didn't. Yeah. And it's, you know, worth bearing that in mind. Yeah. We're not Venezuela. Thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
Like, for example, in Nicaragua, what's happening there right now, a lot of that is about, you know, the Sandinistas had a just revolution. Not everyone would agree with that statement, but I'm going to say it, right? Mm. And they got rid of a really, really bad dictator, took over the country, made a lot of good positive changes for the average person there, especially the poor people. They reduced illiteracy rates. They helped bring down infant mortality rates. And then there were a lot of idealistic young people from the United States, Europe, and Canada that went down there and helped the revolution. Really made a difference for the average person. And guess what? The institutions, they never, for whatever reason, they were never built. Mm. And so all that wonderful work, right? They're just practically back to where they started. And now, you know, you've got the Daniel Ortega. I don't think he's a good person. I don't think he's a good administrator. And I think the country's back where it was when the Sandinistas overthrew Somoza. Sandinistas turned into, I mean, not Sandinista, Daniel Ortega has turned into Somoza. Now he's suppressing the rights of the press and reneging on pensions and, you know, mm-hmm. basically betraying the workers that trusted the government.
Right.
I'm just saying, those institutions never emerged. Yeah. And in the United States, they've been solid for over, 200 and something years. And so, yeah.
I know you cannot directly talk shit about your boss, so I'll do it for you. I get where you're going with that. That in spite of what's clearly just quackery at the highest level, ordering things around, there's an apparatus in place that's mm-hmm. not going to fall apart in spite of having a horrible leader.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, anybody can see that. I mean,
yeah.
Really, what's changed for the average American? You know, this is all entertainment. It's all squawk, squawk, squawk out there.
It's just embarrassing. It's embarrassing, and it's morally kind of repugnant. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that matter on different scales.
But, there are some things that are, there's always things that are embarrassing.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
It makes things a little bit tougher, I think.
Yeah.
I'm doing visa work. I go.
Good luck in Beirut, my man. Good
Thanks,
luck in Beirut.
I
yeah,
it.
Man. Well, hey. Wish you the very best of luck.
Thanks, I appreciate it. Yeah.
Do you know how to say goodbye in Arabic yet?
No, I should. I learned it and I went in one ear.
Well, assalam is...
Assalamu alaikum is a greeting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like Hawaii where you can say
no.
assalam. It means hello and goodbye.
I know, alhamdulillah, which is, God willing. Inshallah is another God willing.
Yeah, inshallah.
I think alhamdulillah is more like praise God or,
I don't know.
Allahu Akbar is praise God. Right. I know the first book of the Quran.
Yeah?
Yeah, I can recite it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's a good start.
Yeah.
Going to be a challenge, but it keeps you young.
Yeah, right. Or ages you prematurely. One of those two.
Oh, gosh, I hope not.
Cheers.
See the dwarfs and see the giants. Which one would you choose to be? And if you can't get that together, here's the answer, here's the key. You can freeze like a 30-century man, like a 30-century man. I'll save my breath and take it with me till 100 years or so. Shame you won't be there to see me shaking hands with Charles de Gaulle. Play it cool and saran wrap all you can. Be a 30-century man. You can freeze like a 30-century man, like a 30-century man.
Hi, Tiffany here, saying thank you for listening to the Monkey Tooth Podcast. If you haven't already, or it's been a while, check out our website, mtp.dog. There's plenty of information there. An About tab with a little bio on Andrew, myself, and our dog Pele. There's also a Van Build tab detailing how we did our van conversion. A Journal tab, and we, as in Andrew, are doing our best to keep that up to date. And last but not least, a contact tab, where you can leave your thoughts, suggestions, or questions. You can also contact us on social media We are on Facebook and Instagram, Monkey Tooth Podcast. If you would like to donate and or subscribe to the cause, you can go to Patreon and GoFundMe at Monkey Tooth Podcast. Patreon is not just a place to subscribe. We post lots of content there as well. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. Love to all.